Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hello and welcome to The Back Half, the New Statesman's Culture podcast with me, Tom.
And me, Kate.
And we have a special guest this week, our film critic, Ryan Gilbey. Hello, Ryan.
Hi, Tom.
Kate and Ryan, did you have any Halloween adventures yesterday?
Well, fittingly, I actually saw Halloween on Halloween.
Okay.
Well, that's
handy
because
apparently we're going to talk about that
later.
We are
going to talk about it. And it was near the Angel Hire, which is the only kind of famous costume shop in London, and there was a little queue of people outside it getting scary outfits, which was nice because then I kind of feel we're getting more and more like America when I see that.
But we'll really be like America when we don't have to wear scary things, won't we? Because friends of mine have dressed as Hall & Oates for Halloween, who live in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
They've dressed amazingly as Hall & Oates. So I think that's when we'll fully be Americanized.
It's true. There's no the rule there is just fancy
just dress up,
right?
Yeah.
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 I mean, Hall & Oates, that's quite horrific. The mullet and the moustache, but still, it's technically not horror.
I went to an evening of readings of experimental literature at Goldsmiths University for the Goldsmiths Prize.
Were they spooky readings?
They weren't. There was nothing spooky about it other than the ride home on the overground, where you just get that kind of quite comical sight of like just people slumped in their chair in like full kind of skeleton face paint or like bloody clothes. I was sitting next to couple. We had quite a big fight in our house about who was going to be the skeleton and who was going to be the witch.
Ah, yeah.
Which had been lined up.
Wow.
It'd been lined up for a week that
so who won, you or your
my
wife?
My son wanted to be the witch, right?
Progressive.
Fine. Yeah. Basic witch. My daughter was going to be the skeleton, and then this is classic for my son. On the last day, he just flipped it and said he wanted to be the skeleton.
Does he have one of those? My brother had a all black kind of lycra suit with glow in the dark bones on it.
He had an all in one.
It's one of those. Yeah.
Great. Yeah.
They presumably make adult ones as well.
I guess so. I'd struggle to fit into John's. All was well that ended.
The way Ryan was like, was it you or your wife that wanted to be the witch?
Best to ask. My brother built a replica of the booth from Big, you know, that grants the wish for the little boy to turn into Tom Hanks. Well, he doesn't wish to turn into Tom Hanks. He wishes to be my Halloween wish is that I turn into Tom Hanks, just not in Forrest Gump, please.
He built the booth.
Yeah, he built a booth and
he dressed up as it.
Yeah. That would be something. No, his wife sat inside and was like the fortune teller. Oh,
brilliant.
This is for a party. Or something,
yeah,
is
for
it?
A Halloween
amazing,
party.
Amazing.
And what did I do? I went to see a scary movie.
How can we live up to that? So we are going to be talking about the new Halloween film. Was it? Is it just called Halloween?
It's called
in
Halloween,
one of those kind of reboot,
isn't it?
Reboot ways.
Yeah, just Halloween.
It's a confident gesture, just calling it Halloween.
And then we're going to be hearing from some of the spookily experimental writer. I mean, they're not. Experimental is a terrible word. It's a banned word. We're going to be hearing from the writers shortlisted for the 2018 Goldsmiths Prize, which is run in association with the New Statesman. And we will have, as usual, our anniversary of a non-significant cultural event.
Speaking of banned words, we found out today in our editorial meeting that the word massive is banned in the New Statesman.
Although weirdly, we then had a conversation about massive attack, and I was wondering
if we
cover them, will we have to rename them huge attack?
Huge attack. So we're allowed huge, and we're not even allowed vast, but massive, it has to apply specifically to mass, apparently. So it's a lazy thing to say massive unemployment.
This has always been, I've known this for a long time because this was the case at the Times as well. But weirdly, if you're ever writing for comic effect, massive is inherently funny and none of the other words are.
Yeah.
So I used to have big arguments with sub-editors who would take massive out of kind of funny columns and replace it with large. And
yeah. It does have the same effect. No. Is the list quite long of our banned words?
They just come up, don't they? I don't know if we've actually got a printout of it, but there's a few, like famous is not allowed, is it?
Or famously.
And legendary and things like
that.
Yeah,
legendary.
Iconic.
Anything that's kind of slightly a weakener to the word that comes after it. But I always thought that monumental is funny in the way that massive is funny. Because it builds up even more.
Yeah.
Monumental prick.
Yeah. And
Kate
on that
wasn't
bombshell,
looking either of us, as she said,
no, she did. She looked straight into my eyes and made a hand gesture.
So, Halloween 2018, but it is just literally called Halloween.
Just Halloween, back to basics.
So this is, I mean, I know they're pretending that a lot of the Halloweens in between never happen, but how many have there been in total? Do we know?
There have been. I think there were 6 or 7 sequels, including H2O. Which was great. And the big one in 1998. It kind of, I mean, people weren't using the word reboot then, but it did reboot the series.
Yeah.
And it had, who was the rapper who was in it?
Oh, yeah.
LL Cool J was making a lot of films around then. So I'm thinking it might have been him. But
might have been him.
It had a kind of, it was very kind of youth skewed.
Yeah.
And it was quite exciting. I remember it being lots of fun. Although within those kind of 6 or 7 sequels, there was also one, Halloween 3, Season of the Witch, which interestingly had nothing to do with Michael Myers or
really?
Halloween.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a complete separate story.
Yeah.
In the similar way, you know, Cat People and Curse of the Cat People, the second film had nothing to do with the first. Apart from people who made it. So I thought that was interesting. It went right off.
Yes,
And then there was a remake by Rob Zombie and a sequel to the remake. It got very confusing.
Because Jamie Lee Curtis was in H2O, wasn't she?
Yeah,
she was a very ballsy character, and Josh Hartnett was her son.
Yeah, but we have to forget everything that happened.
We have
in
to
those
forget
films
it.
Because this just acts as if there was the first film, 1978, and then this takes place 40 years later. And nothing that we know from the sequels actually happened.
Yeah.
So can you just remind us of the premise of the first movie? Briefly?
Well, it's one of those, I don't know about you, Ryan, but I still think it's probably the best horror film ever made.
It's incredible. I watched it last year and it was still terrifying.
Yeah, because it's so simple, isn't it?
So simple, so effective, and also such a great use of the widescreen, of widescreen cinematography, that thing of it having lots of empty space on screen, so you never know where the shock is going to arise from. It reminds me of that thing of like when you play tennis and badminton, you're told to look for the empty spaces in the court so you can wrong foot your opponent. And it's that you never know where, you know, which window is the face going to pop up at.
Yeah, and against that you also always have the taking place on Halloween, so you have the wide shots of the reveries going on and the streets, and people in their costumes and not knowing who's safe and who isn't, because he can just walk into the scene and he might just be somebody in a scary mask the way somebody else.
So simple and so terrifying. And also that great score that John Carpenter does a lot of his own scores, most of his own scores, I think. And that kind of just really insidious, crunchy, horrible electronic score that he has for it, which is used in the new film as well. There's no beating it, really.
For me, it's the premise of it basically just a guy called Michael Myers, who at the age of 6 stabbed his sister, was very mentally disturbed, and then comes back as an adult and attacks Jamie Lee Curtis, who is babysitting at that point.
That's right. This is like 15 or 16 years after he kills his sister. Yeah, he comes back to that neighbourhood. And it's interesting because you wrote in the magazine a few weeks ago, Kate, about being tired of all this psychology for villains in Disney films. So, you know, Maleficent isn't actually a bad witch. She's just misunderstood, and she's actually got really, really sweet impulses and things like that. And weren't you kind of making a pill for let's have some...
Yeah.
And Michael Myers is the ultimate.
Yeah, he's got no backstory. He's got no voice. You never see his face. Mm. And it's just brilliantly done, because he's wearing this mask that is the urban legend is that this mask is basically a William Shatner mask, right? From
Oh, that's right. I thought it was Nixon, but you're right. It's Shatner.
It's a Shatner one that they found somewhere. And then they did the first Halloween. And when it came to doing the second, they couldn't locate the old mask or something like that. And then they just called up some costume stores with a serial number and realized it had been like a kind of really shitty William Shatner mask that he goes around in. And he's also got, I think he's got quite a tender kind of name, Michael Myers, and they refer to him as Michael all the way through it. So you never, he's an absolute monster. You never see him and you never hear him, but it's like, you know, come on, Michael, come away from there, come with me now. And it's like a strange thing for a villain to be called Michael.
It is really strange. And it's good, isn't it? Because he doesn't say anything. So obviously he hasn't got any catchphrases or anything like that. Mm. You know, it's not a kind of Schwarzenegger, you know, I'll be back kind of thing. In a way, you're right. Everybody else's reactions, they do kind of, they make us fear him, obviously, but also they do kind of humanize him in a way.
Yeah.
He's just this blank slate. And you see that really interestingly in the first scene of the new film, where he is completely still in a prison yard, and all the other inmates around him are going absolutely nuts and like they're terrified and they're kind of, he's just this blank slate.
Yeah.
And we're scared because everybody else is scared.
And you don't see his face at that point because he hasn't refound his mask and sort of got back in the game, as it were. But that's
got in touch with his inner child.
Yeah, yeah. It's a hilarious opening scene where it's so stylized, where he's basically in a prison yard with all these like freaks and weirdos who are howling like dogs, and they're all chained up, and they're kind of they're feeding off this strange evil energy from him and going like and things like that. It's just absolutely ludicrous.
Have they ever tried? Because I watched the first film for the first time 2 days ago, so I'm very fresh from this.
What did you think?
Because I instinctively resist horror films generally as a genre. So it took me a little while to adjust to it, but I thought it was kind of amazing for the reasons that you've said. It also, I don't know, maybe there's precedent for this, but it kind of really nailed that eeriness of suburbia as well, that you realize you've seen in loads of subsequent films, that the way of making kind of cozy white picket American streets really sort of terrifying. Mm. But the thing I was sort of grappling with was trying to work out sort of logic behind, or you know, some sort of motivation behind the killings. And I was sort of reading what critics were writing around the time, and the fact that, you know, well, does he pick on people who are kind of sexually promiscuous? Or but I was just wondering, in the subsequent films, have they kept this very pure sort of motiveless idea, or have they ever tried to sort of flesh him out?
I haven't seen all the sequels and remakes of various things, but as far as I know, you don't really go into psychology, because one of the interesting things about the new film is that there are two characters who are, they're both British, aren't they, those reporters? And they're looking for the psychology. Right. They want the story behind
it's very modern.
It.
Yeah.
Exactly.
That's quite nice.
We're long-form journalists, they say.
Do they?
Yeah, they do. Yeah, we're investigative journalists. We're making a podcast. Yeah, making a podcast.
Reflects well on us here today. But yeah, they're saying this to Laurie, Jamie Lee Curtis.
Yeah.
And you know, we want to understand him. And she's saying, wait, he killed 5 people and we have to understand him as a human being. And it reminded me of that chilling thing that John Major said after the murder of James Bulger. Do you remember when he said, we need to understand a little less and condemn a little more?
Wow.
It all seemed to be like playing into the fears we have of not regarding these people as monsters.
Yes.
You know, it's very easy to say.
I quite like that part of her. So basically, she's been sort of holed up in this compound since the original attack, getting more and more paranoid and arming herself with millions of guns and sort of.
She's like Grandma Rambo.
She's Grandma Rambo, yeah. But it's true that she's not. She wants to lure him, as the film develops, she realizes she wants to lure him back, doesn't she, in order to actually kill him. Mm. That's the point. She doesn't want him in prison. And she's praying for him to get released. So there's that great line where somebody says, that's a dangerous thing to pray for, because of course he does have this big prison break and he crashes this bus.
Yeah, it's kind of a seduction, isn't it, between them? It's like she wants him back to kind of settle this.
But not with too much of the corny kind of, we're not so different, you and I crap that you get in these things at all. She just basically wants to dispatch him finally. So they've kept the character of Myers kind of fairly pure and unadulterated, but what else have they done to it to bring it up to 2018? What feels quite now about it?
Well, just the effort that they've gone to make the characters or victims, as most of them become, actually be likable and interesting. Like there are a couple of scenes in particular involving children. There's a little boy who's driving in a truck with his dad, and they're having a conversation. His dad wants to spend more time with him, and the boy's saying, but I want to do my dance class, which is quite an interesting little bit of characterization. And also another little boy later in the film who's with his babysitter, and they have kind of they're kind of like verbally sparring, aren't they, together? And that's all really interesting stuff. And it just makes you fear for them. You don't want these people to get slaughtered. And there are kind of like awkward teenage boys who kind of meet the sharp end of Michael Myers' knife.
And, did you notice that bit where he doesn't, because you kind of expect him to be endowed with some sort of moral compass, and you hope he's not going to be, because that's not the point. But there's one point where he doesn't stab a baby. Do you remember?
That's right. That's right. He
does kill an eight-year-old.
Yeah, he's got standards.
You've got to draw the line somewhere. Yeah.
I thought it was a very modern moment when one of the teenagers says something like, look, within the scheme of things, with what's going on at the world at the moment, a guy stabbing a couple of people is no big deal.
That's really, you're right. That's really 2018. I think that's definitely the mark of the director and co-writer, David Gordon Green. He's not as good a filmmaker as Richard Linklater, but I think he's got a similar sensibility in that he takes situations that might be kind of trashy or basic or unpromising and kind of invests them with sort of conscience in a way. I mean, he started out as an art house director and then kind of took a sharp move into the mainstream with Pineapple Express, if you remember that, with James Franco and Seth Rogen, and has gone on to make like quite a lot of these stoner comedies. But they're always really interested in their characters. They're not just kind of the same old jokes. And his whole background, his whole passion is 80s kind of straight to video gory action films. And he kind of always paying homage to stuff like that. And I could really feel his personality in the film, especially in that line you just quoted about.
What did you think about the mother-daughter relationships at the heart of it as well?
Yeah, that's really interesting too, because I think you can see from fairly early on where we're heading. It's going to be a kind of three generations of the Strode family kind of uniting against Michael Myers. Women were always, well, usually the victims in slasher movies. And you had kind of, you know, this idea of the final girl, the last woman remaining who would confront the killer. But the idea of having three generations of women, I think, at the end of the film is quite a radical one.
With this totally dispensable dad as well, who's my favourite line that the dad says, it's like, he says something like, leave me to protect my family. I know jujitsu. He just gets like his neck
broken. This is the opposite to one of the recent, probably the most recent horror film, or vaguely horror film I saw, which was that A Quiet Place, which we discussed on the podcast, where the father is, you know, or learns every survival technique and, you know.
But it's still weirdly useless, right?
Yeah, I guess he is, yeah.
Yeah, but then he's kind of idealised at the end, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Well, maybe I shouldn't spoil it for anyone who hasn't seen it. But anyway. I thought there were lots of really, also, I mean, you say about 2018 stuff, there were lots of really interesting little tweaks and twists on the formula, which anyone who's seen the first Halloween will recognise. There's that famous shot in the first film where, I think, Tom, you've seen it more recently than us, but Michael Myers is shot and falls off the balcony.
Yeah.
Is that right? Well, there's a balcony scene here. Sounds like Romeo and Juliet. There's a balcony scene here that plays with that, isn't there, if you remember? And also the credit sequence. The credit sequence of the original film shows a pumpkin burning on the left-hand side of the screen, the flame inside. Well, here we've got a pumpkin like reinflating after having kind of collapsed next to the credits and kind of the flame, you know, it's wound backwards, the footage.
It's great. It's a really long intro credit sequence. When did they stop front loading films with credits?
You exactly when it stops. Brilliant. Because I remember noticing it. 1984, okay. Ghostbusters.
Really?
Because all the credit sequence of the original Ghostbusters is just the Ghostbusters sign. Right. There are no credits.
Yeah.
You get a little burst of the music and then it just moves on.
Yeah.
And I remember being struck when I saw that, like, wait.
We've been
cheated. And actually people like Quentin Tarantino and Edgar Wright have moved back to doing elaborate.
Yeah.
I remember when Edgar Wright screened Scott Pilgrim to Quentin Tarantino, and Tarantino was like, no, wait, you haven't got a credit sequence. You need a big epic credit sequence. And then that ended up being one of the best parts of the film.
Wow, I wonder why they changed it.
I wonder if it's like, we'd have to find out how much it costs to do a credit sequence.
Yeah. Or do they think people aren't going to be ready yet, or they're getting their popcorn or some cynical reason.
Also,
like,
do you
think
it's short attention spans? Because, you know, there's that thing on streaming services like Netflix where you have a button to skip the credits.
To skip the credits, it might be.
Skip the credits. Saul Bass would be turning in his
I still find it, I was wondering whether I found it scary because I was thinking about like the way we view things now, and I was kind of checking my phone quite a lot during it.
Hey, were you checking Kate, were you honestly checking the phone in the cinema?
I was checking my phone in the cinema.
I would have called the manager on people.
And then I thought, I'm not scared. But then in the middle of the film, I had to go for a wee. Oh my God, I was terrified because I was in the Odeon Covent Garden and it was an afternoon screening and it was completely deserted. And I went out this corridor and I was suddenly stuck in this like labyrinth of back staircases and fire exits and things. And just because there's a whole scene in it where like someone gets killed in a toilet stall, right?
That's right.
And I went into this old school Odeon type, you know, toilet with a big makeup bar and things like that. And it was just completely deserted. And I just thought I was going to hear this plodding of footsteps coming. I was really scared.
You've got a script right there. You need to pitch that.
And then when I got back into the auditorium, I was so relieved that there were other people. But then I thought one of them could just put on a Michael Myers mask and stab me in the neck. All this went through my head.
Well, look, I would have done it if I'd seen you checking your phone. So beware.
We're not allowed to ruin anything, are we? But I did feel a bit cheated because I felt it was setting up for a sequel at the end, which nowadays I just find like I want to get my money back when I can see that they're making a sequel. So like, I came to see this film.
It kind of comes with the territory with a film like this, don't you think? I mean, because there have been this never-ending like proliferation of sequels. And even as you said before, even when he's been killed in previous episodes, he still just comes back. So, but anyone who hasn't seen it should stay right to the very end of the credits because there is an extra little. I mean, it's not like the Marvel films where you get a whole scene, but there's a little kind of hint at the end.
Yeah, it did remind me a bit the ending of the bit in Austin Powers when he rigs up that sort of sharks with lasers on their heads bit, and his son goes like, "What? You're not even going to stay to watch him being eaten by the sharks with lasers?
I will leave you in an easily escapable situation." It's funny you mentioned that because I was really, really holding out for a Mike Myers, Michael Myers joke in this.
Yes.
Because to mention Edgar Wright again, there was one in Baby Driver where the criminals, the bank robbers are sent out to get their Michael Myers masks and they all come back with Austin Powers masks. Oh. But maybe that would have been just a little bit too meta for this Halloween.
I guess you've got to be really careful with your level of, you've got to pitch your level of in-jokes right, haven't you?
You don't kind of
completely deflate it, but there's enough sort of nods and winks for the
people. And it was never a funny film. That's what I like about it. It is dark and claustrophobic and serious, and you don't want it to like turn into Scream, which was itself commenting on those films.
Yeah, so you get nervous laughter after each scare, but yeah, there's definitely no kind of outright jokes, are there?
So Halloween is in cinemas.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Wow.
Yeah.
Last night I was at Goldsmiths University for an event with all 6 writers shortlisted for this year's Goldsmiths Prize. That's the prize which is run in association with the New Statesman. And its mission is to identify and reward everything that's ambitious, innovative, and risk-taking in the novel, in the British and Irish novel, to be specific. This year's prize is judged by Elif Shafak, Nicholas Lezard, Deborah Levy, and Adam Mars-Jones. And as usual, the shortlist is a really good primer of what's most interesting in this year's fiction. The list features Rachel Cusk for Kudos, the third novel in the trilogy that began in 2014 with Outline, Will Eves for Murmur, a novel about a gay mathematician based on Alan Turing. Guy Gunaratne for In Our Mad and Furious City, which follows five characters on a London estate over 48 hours. Gabriel Giospovici for The Cemetery in Barnes, an examination of a life lived in three locations and told in three interweaving voices. Olivia Lang for Crudo, a rapid-fire piece of autofiction set during the summer of 2017. And Robin Robertson for The Long Take, which was also shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize. It's a verse novel following a D-Day veteran pacing the streets of Manhattan, New York, and San Francisco. Before the event, we met with the writers and asked them to talk about and read a little bit from their books. The winner will be announced at Goldsmiths on November the 14th. Until then, here is your little guide to the 2018 Goldsmiths Prize shortlist.
I'm Rachel Cusk, and my novel Kudos has been shortlisted for the Goldsmiths Prize. Kudos is the third book in a trilogy. The books share a sort of distinctive form in that they're written by a sort of inside-out rule of narrative where everything is on the outside and nothing is on the inside. They have a narrator who sort of embodies this principle by being very silent and invisible and hearing really the stories of people's lives, but it isn't... that's sort of one way of describing it. To me, it doesn't feel like that particularly. It feels like a sort of grasping of, an innate human sense of form and narrative. And that's what the book uses to sort of tell itself. I'm the bridesmaid here. This is my third time of being shortlisted. At this point, I feel we've grown old together. So, you know, I'm very pleased to be here again. And it's good to have a prize that applauds the exercise of artistic freedom, which is what we're all here for. So, yeah, I'm very pleased.
Hello, my name's Will Eves, and I've written this book, Murmur, which takes as its point of departure the last few years in the life of the logician and computer science pioneer, Alan Turing, who was convicted of gross indecency with another male in 1952 and sentenced to organotherapy, which was a sort of punitive hormonal regimen, effectively a kind of a very strong bromide, which changed his body, changed his mind too. And the book is an attempt to understand how he might have responded as a material scientist to that transformation. So I'm going to read just a little bit from an extract of fictional journal, which bookends the novel. I think empathy is a treated, enhanced version of sympathy, but I am not sure it exists. We can't be in someone else's emotional shoes. We don't ever feel what they're feeling. What makes us cry or makes our heart race is probably just this intense awareness of not quite, of being so close to feeling what they're feeling. I'd go so far as to say that empathy is a sort of artifice. And what, one might ask, is wrong with that?
I'm Guy Gunaratne, I'm the writer of In Our Mad and Furious City. And In Our Mad and Furious City is a book set on a housing estate in Northwest London. And it follows four voices from the estate after a terrorist incident involving the killing of an off-duty soldier. The voices are written in distinct vernacular. The three young contemporary voices of young men are written in road dialect, sometimes called MLE, Multicultural London English. And the two older characters, one is Carolyn, who speaks to her experience in Northern Ireland, in Belfast, during the Troubles. And it's written in Northern Irish dialect. And Nelson, who's an elderly character, who speaks to his experience as a new immigrant in London in the 1950s during the Notting Hill race riots. And his voice is written in West Indian Patois. The book, I guess, is really sort of looks at extremism and the nature of extremism and how it manifests itself over time. And each of the voices have to confront their own compulsions towards extremes in a city like London, which is quite an extreme city in itself. There were things that I learned to call fury as a younger. Fury was a fearsome drum, some hungry and hot temper, ill spirit or madness, and never touched us for long, but followed our bodies for time. See London. This city taints its young. If you're from here, you'd know, wouldn't it? All our faces were pinched sour. Even the good few I spent my early way with, we were all born into the menace from day dot. These were the hidden violences, day-long deaths that snuffed out our small and limited futures. We grew up around these towers, so struggle was a standard echo in our speech, in thought, in action. But it was only after the release of that one video, clip from a phone of a witness, that everyone else saw the truth. The image on every news channel and paper, a black boy had killed an off-duty soldier. Soldier Boy, we called him. The black younger had stopped Soldier Boy and struck him down with a cleaver. Then he wrapped his body in a black cloth and strung him up from a road sign. Stuff was dark. Darkest, because it happened in a space so familiar. In our city, on road and in broad daylight. The sound of the black boy's voice came next, shouting into the camera about the infidel, the sinful kuffar. It was on radio and television, an endless loop. He called himself the Hand of Allah, but to us, he looked as if he'd just rolled out the same school gates as us. He had the same train as we wore, spoke the same road slang we used. The blood was not what shocked us. For us, it was his face like a mirror, reflecting our confused and frightened hearts. Violence made this city. Those living, born and raised, grew up with it like an older brother. And on that final day when flames lit the domes of our painted mosque, we were all far beyond saving. Fury was like a fever in the air, a corrupt mass of bodies pulsing together in pain and rhetoric. Mahajirun were herding our people along August Road and had us stand on the burnt earth like a testament. There was violence in our brotherhood, that much is clear, though we never knew how much of that violence came from us or the road beneath our feet. We were London's scowling youth, and as siblings of rage, we were never meant to stray beyond the street. We might not have known it with our eyes so alight, but it was true. A miseducation is proof, innit? Those school corridors were like coal chambers. Anyone who went to St. Mary's would attest. Our bodies were locked for verbal assaults, our words clipped and surging, and with our own code, and fuck anyone else who disagreed, you know? Violence shattered our language, and our lines tagged the streets. They'd read us on walls in open seam and dim lamplight. We'd cotch and park benches, waste air, sock-mouthed and bound, stupid at our fates the entire time. Our tongues were so soaked in our defences, we hoped only to outlast the day. Just look at how we spoke to one another. In it, though, my man and pussy, oh. Our friendships we called bloods, and our homes we called our ends. We revelled in throwing crafted curses at our mothers and receiving hard slaps to heads. Our combs cut lines in our hair, and we scarred our eyebrows with blades. We became warrior tribes of man them, slave kings and palm-swiping cubs we were. Our parents knew nothing. And most others only knew us from the noise made at the back of the buses. Close without touch. That was the only love permitted, though it was deeply felt among our own. We smoked weed together, borrowed idioms and shopped American verses. In our caustic speech, we threw out platitudes and our guts, our feisty wit. It was like we lived upon jagged teeth in the dark in this bone-cold London city, a young nation of mongrels, constantly measuring ourselves against what we were supposed to be, which was what I couldn't tell you. For those of us who had an elsewhere in our blood, some foreign origin, who had richer colours and ancient callings to hear, fight with more likely and fight for, a push-pull of ancestry and meaning. For me, that meant Pakistan and its local mosques, which in Neasden meant going mosque and dodging Mahajirun. For my brothers on estate, they were from all over. Jamaicans, Irish Pikeys, Nigerians, Ghanaians, South Indians, Bengalis. Proper Commonwealth kids, isn't it? Even the Arab squaddies from UAE. We'd all spy those private schoolboys from Belmont and Mill Hill, and we'd wonder, how would it have felt to come from the same story? To be moulded out of one thing and not of many. There was nothing more foreign to us than that, nothing more boring and pale to imagine. Ours was a language, a dubbing of noise, while theirs was a one note, void of new feeling and any sense of place. Place was our own, this place. And whether we heard the whispers of our older roots never mattered. What mattered for us was the present, terse and cold, where we'd make our own coarse music. This was where we found our young madnesses, after all, on road, or rather between the roads we knew and the world we felt we could never hope to claim. So it was like watching our faces made foul when we saw that video, when that soldier boy was butchered by a homegrown brother. That's when we knew we were all lost to the ruin. And they called it terrorism, but terrorism never felt so close. Even when we saw the madness rise, when the hijab lady was slashed in the car park in Brickey, or when Michael was knifed in North, the swell only peaked after that soldier boy's killing. And I think about why it had to be a younger that done it. Why it was that when we saw the eyes of the black boy with the dripping blade, we felt closer to him than the soldier boy slain in the street. But now I know this city and its sickness of violence and mean living. These things come in sharp ruptures that don't discern. It was the fury, horror curled into horror, violence trailing back for centuries. I heard as much in mosque and from rude boys on road. So when the riots blew up in the square, when the Umar came out and the Union Jack burned in the June air, the terror had become unwound and lightweight. Each of us were caught in the same swirl, all held together with our own small furies in this single, mad, monstrous and lunatic city.
I'm Gabriel Giuseppevici. I've written a novel called The Cemetery in Barnes. It actually sprang out of a short story I'd written many, many years ago, which I was quite happy with, but was very, very compressed. And I felt over the years that I needed to open it up and spread it out and let it breathe a bit more. And I kept thinking about it, sketching in a few things, and then leaving it. I had other things to do. And then finally, after the end of my, after I had finished the last novel of mine that Carcanet published, I thought, well, this is the moment. I hadn't got anything else on the books. I ought to get down to it. And this is the book. He had been living in Paris for many years. Longer, he used to say, than he cared to remember. When my first wife died, he'd explain, there no longer seemed to be any reason to stay in England. So he moved to Paris and earned his living by translating. The beauty of a translator's job, he would say, is that you can do it anywhere and you don't ever need to see your employer. When a book is done, you send it off and in due course you receive the remainder of your fee. Meanwhile, you've started on the next one. He was an old-fashioned person, still put on a jacket and tie to sit down to work, and a coat and hat when he went out. Even at the height of the Parisian summer, he never ventured out without his hat. At my age, he would say, it's too late to change. Besides, I'm a creature of habit, always was. He lived in a small apartment at the top of a peeling building in the Rue Lucrèce, behind the Pantheon. To get to it, you went through the dark, narrow Rue Saint-Julien, and climbed the steep flight of steps which brought you out directly opposite the building. There were, of course, other ways of getting there, but this was the one he regularly used. It was how, in his mind, his little flat was linked to the outside world.
I'm Olivia Lang. I'm a writer and critic, and I'm the author of Crudo, which is my first novel. It's a book about Trump and Brexit, about anxiety and love, about living at what might be the end of the world and trying to learn the skills of intimacy in a disintegrating universe. Oh, I am beyond thrilled to be shortlisted. I spent some time last night just looking through all of the previous shortlists, and it's an extraordinary range of experiment and endeavor. It's people from very small presses and much more well-known writers, and that kind of mix with a sort of sharing of ingenuity, risk-taking, beauty of language just feels unprecedented. I can't think of another prize that has that sort of range, so I'm beyond happy to be here. Cathy, by which I mean I, was getting married. Cathy, by which I mean I, had just got off a plane from New York. It was 7:45 on the 13th of May, 2017. She'd been upgraded to business. She was feeling fancy. She bought two bottles of duty-free champagne in orange boxes. That was the kind of person she was going to be from now on. Kathy was met at the airport by the man she was living with, soon to become the man she was going to marry, soon, presumably, to become the man she had married, and so on till death. In the car, the man told her that he had eaten dinner with the man she, Kathy, was sleeping with, along with a woman they both knew. They had also been drinking champagne, he told her. They laughed a lot. Kathy stopped speaking. This was the point at which her life took an abrupt turn, though in fact the man with whom she was sleeping would not break up with her for another 5 days on headed writing paper. He didn't think two writers should be together. Kathy had written several books, Great Expectations, Blood and Guts in High School. I expect you've heard of them. The man with whom she was sleeping had not written any books. Kathy was angry. I was angry, and then I got married.
My name is Robin Robertson. I'm originally from the northeast coast of Scotland, but I've lived in this city, London, for most of my life. And the book that I've written is called The Long Take, and it was written because I made a decision to write about the city, having lived in a city most of my life, but never having written about it before, I thought I would correct this error of judgment. And what this is a story of an outsider in the city, and I wanted to return to some of the ambivalence I felt as a young Scot arriving in the seething metropolis. And that strange mixture of glamour and disgust, excitement and fear. But rather than write about London, which seemed too close, I thought I would write about American cities. I've been traveling in the States since I was 20. And this gave me some distance. And I almost immediately decided they would have to be set in the post-war years when the jazz was at its best and the films were at their finest. And so it grew from there. The outsider became an ex-soldier, a Canadian veteran with PTSD, who couldn't return to his own island of Nova Scotia because of what he'd seen and what he'd done, and so did what many ex-servicemen did in those years. He went into the city looking for anonymity and repair. And it's his journey that forms the spine of this book, through the streets of Manhattan to Los Angeles and San Francisco and back finally to Los Angeles, where he finds in the end some form of community. And there it was, the swell and glitter of it like a standing wave, the fabled smoking ruin, the new towers rising through the blue, the ranked array of ivory and gold, the glint, the glamour of buried light as the world turned round it very slowly this autumn morning, all amazed. And it stayed there, watching as they made toward it, the truck driver and the young man, under pylons, wires, utility poles, past warehouses, container parks, deserted lots, between the long, oily marshes, landfill sites and swamps, before slipping down under the Hudson and coming up on the other side to find a black wetness of streets trashed and empty, and the city gone.
So Ryan, just to explain to you, I don't think you've sat on in this part of the podcast before, but this is our non-anniversary, so we find a a cultural event, deep or indeed shallow in the seas of time, and haul it out with our podcast net.
I think I was here for your Just Say on No one. Did you do one on Just Say No?
We did.
The Great Chill.
Okay, yeah. You don't need explaining then. It's on anniversary. And this week we're going to do, I had a look in the archives and discovered that it's 30 years since Enya's Orinoco Flow spent three glorious weeks at number one in the UK top 40.
Most people probably think of it as being called Sail Away.
Sail Away. Or when I looked up the video earlier, I'm sort of more alive to YouTube comments now since having seen Adam Buxton do his various kind of bug shows where he makes a big deal about people's YouTube comments. And someone admitted that they'd always thought that the chorus was Save a Whale, which when you listen to it again is a really...
Well, that's partly to do with her weird swallowing of words, isn't it? That's the thing that always annoyed me about Enya, is you can't make any of the words out. So I looked up what the words were to this.
Yeah.
And I was struck by how banal they are. And they're kind of overblown and also banal. So there's a line where it goes, from Bissau to Palau in the shade of Avalon, from Fiji to Tiri in the Isles of Ebony, from Peru to Cebu, feel the power of Babylon, from Bali to Kali, far beneath the Coral Sea. And then towards the end, it goes... We can steer, we can near with Rob Dickens at the wheel. And he was the man at Warner Records who signed her. So he gets a name check for signing her alongside Tracy Chapman and various other people.
So she incorporates her thank yous, her acknowledgements into the song.
In this like fantastical world of like the power of Babylon and the Coral Sea, you've got Rob Dickens at the wheel. But thank God she doesn't actually say it more clearly, because it may not have sold so many copies.
Maybe that's what Liz Fraser and Michael Stipe sing about in their early exactly. songs where we can't hear what they're saying.
Isn't that the sort of thing you put in as a placeholder and then like, you know, go back and rewrite lyrics here?
Yeah. Oh, like yesterday being scrambled eggs.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It became ubiquitous, of course. Like, I mean, I think of it as kind of, you know, more music, I guess. But it did go on to soundtrack lots of different commercials, you know, the world of interior decoration. It's a Dulux paint ad. It was a big American drinks ad in the States. And it was included on a Virgin compilation called Pure Moods in 1991, which I think was a huge seller.
That's the genre they call New Age, which you don't really hear that much now, but that was big in the 80s. If you did anything that was vaguely world, it was New Age.
Well, she won for this, Enya won Best New Age Performance at the 32nd Annual Grammy Awards. Is that still a category?
I doubt it. What would it be called
I know
now?
They do have thousands of categories at the Grammys, but I can't imagine they still have a New Age category.
New Age is not, it's not fashionable. It's a good song. I was thinking about why it's good, and it's got like three or four different melodic sections to it, so there's kind of a lot going on. And that when I heard it, I was surprised that it was actually all those songs together. I thought they were all different singles that Enya had released, but actually they're all in one. But yeah, it's still a bit annoying.
And did it start a kind of trend of those songs? So I think of that one, was it Enigma and things like that, and
that was also on
The Return to Innocence.
On Pure Moods, right? Yeah. We should get the track listing. I mean, they seem guaranteed. I called it mum music earlier, but it's mum and dad music, isn't it, really? And these things always went to number one, didn't they?
It's also in South Park. There's a scene where, who is it who's got the grandpa? Is it Kyle? His grandpa is like a character, I can't remember, and he shoves Kyle into a cupboard under the stairs and says, you want to know what it's like being old, shoves him into a cupboard under the stairs and plays Enya. It's completely in the darkness and just hearing sail away.
That Pure Moods thing was actually a kind of slightly odd mashup of, you know, it had things like the X-Files theme on it,
right,
and Michael Nyman and Enya and Enigma, but also like a couple of like slightly cooler electronic things. So it was a kind of odd sort of world beat kind of
sounds like a
mashup.
Precursor to the chill out room.
Yeah, I think it was. Yeah. Anyway, happy 30th anniversary to Orinoco Flow. Thank you for downloading this episode of The Back Half. Thanks very much, Ryan, for coming in and sharing it with us. Thank you to Caroline Crampton, our podcast editor. We'll be back in a fortnight. In the meantime, we're going to leave you...
with the non-chill-out song, Pistol Jazz with Godspeed.
even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.